Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour, November 26, 2020, the end of the official hurricane season. And, there were some hurricanes this year, some bad ones, and not because anybody predicted them, but because, I believe there was a lot of manipulation going on this year. But I might do a little bit more review on that next week. First of all, this is the Thanksgiving special, something I do every year because it falls on a Thursday evening, the same night as my show. So there may be families visiting each other, listening to this show, possibly for the very first time, along with other people who have heard it for potentially 20 years. So, by the way, this is called the James McKenney Science Hour at the Crossroads. And there's a reason for that, because since I've been doing this show, literally now for 20 years and continuing, it's commercial free, by the way, so you won't hear any nice jingles or ads or little music or people, whatever. It's commercial free. I sometimes talk a little bit about my own products, but I'll save that till later because I've got some sales going on, some big sales, in fact. But Thanksgiving is a time when we sit down and reflect. And this year, good grief, there's a lot going on. That's an amazing amount of diversion, you might say that. But I'm going to get back to my scientific topics and stay away from anything political in nature. But only to note that the election, interestingly enough, many weeks after the November 3rd election date, the election is still not over. I don't care whose newspaper you are reading or what the slant is. The election is still not over, and there's a lot going on in the background. So anyway, I talk about that on other radio shows. By the way, I was a guest on a radio show this past week in Canada. And so I'm many times invited to speak outside of the country. So this was a small station up in Ottawa, in Ontario, and with the host, Bridget Hayworth is her name. And the name of the show, very interestingly enough, is Walking on Air with Me. So we had a discussion about chemtrail spraying in Canada. But of course, then the topic switched over to the COVID-19 thing because Canada is shut down right now. And there are not rumors. I mean, there's actual discussion in the parliament in Canada about the next wave where they have built basically the same as FEMA camps around Canada. And it appears there's like processing stations which could handle up to maybe 100 people. But then there will be larger camps that those initial camps are feeder camps where people will be screened. And if they don't comply with orders, taking the vaccination, the required vaccination in Canada, they will be shipped off to a COVID-19 treatment center, as they say, a happy camp, where they will be basically incarcerated until they decide it's a good idea to take the vaccination. So anyway, the topic went to that, and the discussions were happening in Parliament. So this is not like conspiracy theory or something that somebody put on a webpage someplace. So anyway, the discussion went to that. And also, there was an interesting show. It's always interesting when you're on a foreign country. I've been on primetime television in Russia. I've been on primetime television in Japan, and the Japanese interview a number of years ago was an interview. The Japanese entire production crew came to my house where I was living at the time, and my studio where we shot 3 hours of basically primetime TV interview. And after this played in Japan, it was the equivalent of 60 minutes in Japan. And so then I asked the producer afterwards, I said, I called her up to get a copy of the actual cut that was done for the television, because we had 3 hours of video. By the way, that video you can see on is for sale on my webpage, and it's one of my DVDs, What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X was the name of the title. And they have a very different perspective. They have not been subjected to all of the total disinformation and just craziness about that topic in the United States. But I asked the producer, I said, how many people watch the show? You know, because in the United States, you might have a football game, you might have other things going on. You know, there might be political shows, it might be people's favorite television show. So something like 60 Minutes gets a prime time Sunday night, they might get a certain percentage of the watching audience. And then there's people who might watch it regularly but didn't watch that night. So in the United States, it's kind of, it's a smaller percentage. But she said in Japan, she just said matter-of-factly, well, everybody watched it. And I'm like, well, you know, there must have been somebody else, somebody watches some other show. She goes, no. That show, everybody in Japan sits down and watches that show. 100% of the people, little kids, grandmas, grandpas, and everybody in between, watch that show. So I was on national primetime 60-minute style TV show. It was a television interview. And literally everybody in Japan saw me for that 1 hour. It was, you know, a lot of information. But you can see the full 3 hours of the interview, which I filmed myself in the studio in the United States when the production crew came. And the producer himself interviewed me, and he did not speak English, so he brought his interpreter with him who translated back and forth. It was really interesting. It's really interesting. So like I say, you can see that whole video. I set up my production camera, high-definition camera in the studio, and just turned it on and let it run for 3 hours. So you can see that interview. Very interesting to see what another culture wants. And then I was in Russian television a number of times, same thing, primetime television, talking about various topics. In fact, this week, interestingly enough, somebody out of the blue sent me an interview that I did with Art Bell back in, was like 1996 or something. And I was, at the time, regular guest on the Art Bell show before it turned into Coast to Coast AM with host George Norrie, which, of course, I've been on there uncounted times. But I was a regular guest with Art back in the old original Art Bell days. So it was interesting listening to that interview where I talked about the Russian space program, which I knew a lot about because I had worked with Russian scientists, Russian atmospheric scientists at the University of Novosibirsk. Anyway, just a few little anecdotes there to get going. And if people want to see my whole resume, it's on my webpage. But just a few thoughts here to begin with. Solar flare. Now, if you've been listening to my show for the past 6 months, every week I have been discussing this idea that there would be a false flag solar flare where NASA would announce this solar flare. And then NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, would declare some kind of weather emergency, which would result in pulling the power grid. And interestingly enough, one of the target weekends would be this weekend, Thanksgiving weekend, where everybody has been encouraged to stay home and not go to your relative's house for Thanksgiving. And when they pull the power grid, and this has been planned for years as one of the final straws in captivating the public, let's just put it that way, would be pulling the power grid. And the way they would do it, since they want it to be done universally, for example, faking an asteroid strike or a meteor stream or other events of major scale, would be very difficult to do as far as taking down the entire power grid, whereas a solar flare would affect potentially the entire world and give them an excuse to pull the power grid everywhere. And of course, with the power grid down, with a new wave and surges of testing of coronavirus, that would give them the complete freedom to install martial law and just shut down the entire, basically the entire world, potentially. So anyway, I just found it interesting that they made a big story over this solar flare this past week. And of course, a lot of times the solar flares are on the other side of the sun, so we cannot see them and then verify them. And even if you could see it, say you had your little backyard solar telescope with the filter on it, and had equipment where you could actually view the sun, and do not look at the sun with your eyes or binoculars. Do not, I say, look through any optical equipment at the sun, but there are special types of equipment that would allow the average person or somebody in a research center to see the solar flares they're talking about. But even if you had that, you would not be able to see the stream of charged particles that would be potentially coming to Earth to cause the alleged power outage. Okay, so anyway, just also to mention quickly, there's a dust storm on Mars, a major dust storm at this time, and it appears to be going global. In other words, the entire planet of Mars will be shrouded in a dust storm. Now, one of the very interesting aspects of that is that Mars has very pristine rivers, riverbeds, creek beds, water washes, deltas of rivers like the Mississippi River Delta or the Nile River Delta, where the water comes down from the river and then builds little islands because of the sediment, and then it becomes this like delta as it fans out into the body of water where it dumps into, in the case of the Mississippi River, into the Gulf of Mexico, in the case of the Nile, up into the Mediterranean, etc. Okay, so the point here is that these pristine riverbeds, when you have a dust storm on Mars, it's like a big sandstorm, and the winds can reach 300 miles an hour. So this is like a sandblasting. And so these pristine riverbeds, etc., on Mars, and geological structures, etc., would be completely destroyed in a matter of a couple hundred years, because these dust storms kick up probably once a year, the big ones, and they have continual dust storms on a smaller scale, including tornadoes with dust. So you have, again, a couple hundred mile an hour winds with this dust blowing around on Mars, and it would destroy these geological features overnight in a couple hundred years. But I did a study, and it's on my webpage, on my picture of the day subpage, where I have photos of just hundreds of these photos of the surface of Mars with these pristine conditions, riverbeds, washes, things like that. And these structures would have been destroyed in very short order. And so what I was doing was pointing out that Mars had oceans and water, lakes, rivers, etc., recently, you know, at maximum a couple thousand years ago. And so anyway, if you read my books, etc., you understand what the reason for that is. I'm not going to spend any more time on that on this show, but you can see that, all that discussion in my books. But the NASA then copied my work, these clowns at Goddard, copied my work and then claimed that these ocean and water geological features were billions of years old. Well, it's absolutely absurd. Nothing would be there. In fact, even on Earth, where we don't have these massive annual dust storms, we have localized weather, but nothing like on Mars, where it's like the whole planet is encompassed in a dust storm. Even on Earth, the geological features don't last billions of years. They are destroyed by weathering processes, etc. Okay, I'm going to take a second out here just to talk about my education package, my book libraries, the water filters and things like that. I'm just going to mention one thing, that almost everything is on sale. So go to my webpage. I'll just give the webpage here once, and then at the end of the show, it's jmccsci.com. And everything is pretty much everything is on sale, not the wing generators or the energy items. They're not on sale, but the water filtration stuff, the books, the book libraries, my education package. The grow towers are never on sale. And those are there where you can raise vegetables, etc., in your house, very clean environment called vertical aquaponics, or I'm sorry, vertical aeroponics, where you can have up to 50 plants in a single tower and raise basically your salads, your vegetables, your herbs, etc., all in this tower. Okay, that's all I'm going to talk about, those items, but lots of things on sale with typically free shipping. Okay, diamonds in the news. Now, this story came out this past week, and it's typically assumed, it's conjectured, that diamonds form deep in the earth, hundreds of miles down under deep pressure and high temperatures, and form, and then because of volcanic action and belching of this material from the center of the earth, in certain locations in Earth, that the diamonds that are then used to cut into jewelry, diamonds, etc., are used in industry as hard cutting devices, edges on saws, etc., that those diamonds are made in the Earth itself. A group this past week found a new process for making micro diamonds. Now, micro diamonds are microscopically small. So this is not like making a diamond ring diamond or anything like that. The diamonds that go into jewelry, earrings and rings and things like that, those are the bigger diamonds. And, of course, there's the great big diamonds that, usually in the crown of royalty or something like that. But they're able to make these extremely small microscopic diamonds. And the reason that's interesting is because you find these diamonds in geological structures. You find the diamonds in layers of dirt that separate boundaries between extinction layer events on Earth, where the majority of animals and plants died and changed. And you find these microdiamonds. You find microdiamonds, for example, in the bones of mastodons that are buried along rivers in Alaska, where the upper side is peppered with these microdiamonds. And so something happened to cause these microdiamonds to form and then spray these areas at exactly the time when there were mass extinctions. And so the mastodons that I'm talking about in the rivers in Alaska, the flooding that occurred that washed them up into these banks and then basically buried them until they were discovered thousands of years later by archaeologists. The upper side of the bones of those animals were peppered with microdiamonds. So this is an interesting event. So what these people did then is they took tremendous pressure with tremendously hard materials and were able to, for very, very quickly, they could put tremendous pressure on a small area. So they were carbon rich. So they were able to bond, and there's a number of different kinds of diamonds, number of different crystalline structures and amorphous structures of carbon, etc., that are very hard, amorphous being non-crystalline. So it's interesting that there's a new process for making these microdiamonds. And so anyway, that's noteworthy. But the reason I'm mentioning this is I was just rereading my book, The Diamond Principle, in which there's a chapter in there about the method of making diamonds in a laboratory and in outer space, in the vacuum of outer space, on the nose side of comets. Now, the process on the nose side of comets is you have an electron beam that's part of the plasma discharge comet model explanation that's my scientific work that explains how comets work. They're not dirty snowballs. They're not melting or sublimating in the heat of the sun. They are electrical discharges. And the microdiamonds are formed on the sunward side in the electron beam coming out from the sun in a carbon-rich environment. And that's how diamonds form. And you can duplicate this process in a laboratory, making microdiamonds, and in fact, very large diamonds. And it's very interesting how this works. The first thing that happens is there's a carbon structure that's made, and they're called, the slang term for them, or the common term, is Buckey balls. Buckminster Fuller described the crystalline structure that could occur in a globular fashion with carbon, because of the carbon being a stable molecule or atom, that it can form these very strong structures. And one of them is like a hollow sphere. And so Buckminster Fuller used that same structure to build basically what you call dome structures, where there's a lattice work. Those lattice pieces represent the covalent bonding of the carbon atoms, and then to build this globular structure. But when you build that, it's extremely strong, and what diamonds need are tremendous pressure. So the tremendous pressure is maintained by this carbon kind of buckyball that is formed in outer space, and then the diamond forms within that. And so these can be big and small, etc., and form in outer space. And there's good reason to believe this, because at the same time when these mass extinction events occur and a large comet is coming by Earth, then you also have the devastation that's going on, the mass extinction, and a source for microdiamonds. So that's the point. So it's just microdiamonds in the news again, and I believe I talked about this process also in my book, Calculate Primes, where I'm talking about the reproduction of physical processes in the universe, so that, for example, that if you have DNA, you're going to have DNA on the far side of the universe that's the same as the DNA we have here. It's a common molecular structure built up of nucleotides hooked together with phosphate structures and phosphorus and other elements, sometimes iron, that build the nucleotides up into the DNA and RNA, etc. Okay, and so the creation of a diamond is a similar situation where you have a process that's repeatable throughout the universe, and therefore, you would expect to find microdiamonds on the far side of the universe and potentially some very large diamonds in the mix. Okay, turning to another item in outer space, another news story, that more and more stars are being discovered with rings around them. And that's simply because observation techniques, people are spending more time with advanced telescope looking at stars nearby. Another one was just discovered with a ultraviolet signature ring around it, and they claim that it was a dual star system that collided and anyway expelled this dust cloud. But then you look, and there are just hundreds and hundreds of stars now that have been discovered with rings around them. And just to put this into perspective, our own solar system has a ring around it also, that if you were away looking at us, if you were far away looking at our sun system, our star system, and the planets, you would find this ring around it. Now, just in perspective, where does that ring set relative to the planets? Well, the distance between the planets grows as you go out farther. And so if you go beyond Pluto, the farthest planet, and Pluto is, in fact, a real planet, let's say twice the distance to Pluto would be where the bulk of this ring would exist, somewhere in that region out there, so really far away from the star. And what's going on is the solar wind, the fusion-based wind that comes out of the star, pushes back. It's like a constant stream of charged particles, and it pushes back. And the heavier atoms and molecules, or I should say the more dense atoms and molecules, stay closer to the sun, so you have iron and other iron compounds close to the sun, And then the lighter, say the nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, are much farther out in the region of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, out in those regions. And then farther out, you might just have lighter hydrogen compounds, and including potentially water. But anyway, what happens out in these regions is planets are forming by the plasma discharge comet model, because it's part of the capacitor, and you can actually see this. You can see the comet structures out there, and these things move very slowly over the period of potentially thousands of year orbits. So they move very slowly, so there any movement or change would be very difficult to detect in the time, say, for example, that man has been looking with telescopes since Galileo just a few hundred years ago. We have not clocked that much telescope time looking at the universe. So a lot of these changes that would take place over, say, a 10,000-year period, only a minor change in 10,000 years, would be very difficult for us to detect, given the short history. And we've only been using good telescopes for about 100 years, and we've only had really good searches and time using these telescopes with good cameras and now digital cameras for only about 20 years. So it's a very short period of time astronomically to view all of the stars around us relative to these rings that are occurring. In my work, I call it the nebular ion cloud, and that's literally what it is. It's a collection of dust and gases that are held back by the solar wind. And so, at any rate, these have been in the news this past week again. I just wanted to mention that because I think I talked to last week or possibly the week before about the fact that there are thousands and thousands of planets. When you went to school or if you took an astronomy course, they talked about there being nine planets. If you included Pluto, then they demoted Pluto from being a planet. Then there were eight planets, and then they're looking for planet nine, some allegedly big planet out at the edge of the solar system, which is pretty funny because NASA denied it for decades, and all of a sudden recently goes, doggone, maybe there is one of these. We better come out and become the experts. So that's a kind of a funny story all itself about how ridiculous those people are. But I've been saying for decades that these rings are part of the solar system, and that's where the bulk of the planets form. NASA has literally discovered thousands of planets in this region around our own solar system. So there are thousands of planets and potentially hundreds, potentially thousands of Jupiter-sized planets out there in this region. So interesting that more study is being done in this type of these types of stars with rings. And I think that eventually, that if you look at almost any star, any active star, I should say, that has a significant solar wind or stellar wind, fusion-based wind, that they would have a donut nebula surrounding them and planets forming. Not just a few planets, but a lot of planets. And by the way, in that outer region, so this would be in the region, like compared to our solar system, way beyond Pluto. And so people think of, if you took that astronomy course in college, or if you read the newspaper or science magazine or textbooks in school, they would have told you there were nine or eight planets, something like that. Outside of those main planets, which are seemingly, well-organized, there are thousands and thousands of planets outside of that, because there's this very rich dust cloud out there held back by the solar wind pressure where these planets are forming. And it's they're forming as comets, and you can literally see the comets in the dust clouds around other stars. Okay, moving on now, just a bit about my history. I spent about 10 years teaching at the university level. People call me Professor James McCanny for a reason, because when I was teaching in foreign universities, I earned that position, professor. And so not only that, but a lot of people call me that out of respect for the years of diligent work that I've done. But in either case, I've spent a lot of time on in education. I've spent a lot of time on the desk side of education as a student, and very diligent work, all of that, taking a lot of time, a lot of effort. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because I do happen to know something about education. And university education, more specifically. But something happened. When I went to college, just to give you an idea of my age, I graduated in 1970 from college. A four-year degree, double major, math, physics. Very, very stringent, very difficult program at a private college, now a private university. Okay, well, that's well and good. But I just want to mention something. My tuition as a senior for throughout my four years of college, my annual tuition was $1,200. 10 years later, that same school was $12,000, and today it would be more like $40,000 a year for just tuition. We're not talking room and board or books or other expenses or food or anything. We're talking tuition. So have the costs of these colleges and universities grown exponentially like that too? Well, I'll tell you something. People who teach today make pretty good salaries, but they're not teaching today. And that's part of the problem. And here's exactly what happened. As the baby boomer generation, of which I'm kind of like the leading edge of the wave of baby boomers being the wave of babies that were born after World War II. I'm kind of the leading edge of that baby boom. What happened is that John Kennedy, signed the student some bills that, and for example, I got stipends along with my scholarship. I had a full ride to college, and so I got a full payment of my tuition. Well, I got matching funds because I, in a sense, earned that money through scholarship, through good grades and being studious. And so then the federal government matched a grant to my education. This is for college, four-year college. This is back in the 60s, thanks to John Kennedy, that paid for my room and board, because my room and board fee at the college, because I lived on campus all 4 years, was $1,200 also. So this is like $2,400 a year. So that's all my living expenses minus books and some other expenses. And then I played in a band, two bands actually, and made some money. This was jazz. I was in a trio, and sometimes we were a quartet when another guy joined us with a saxophone, but it was piano, bass, and drums. I was the bass player. And made a lot of money. I mean, we played for proms, we played for all kinds of events, any kind of event. And then I played with the stage band, which was the college jazz band, like the Woody Herman type of music. And we made money from that, also went on tours, etc. So anyway, that's where my spending money came from, and when I was in college. And so anyway, it was pretty conservative. And I had a car. It wasn't great. Sometimes I had to push it to start it in the wintertime. But that's what life was like in the 60s, going to college at a small private university and then studying. I spent most of my time, I had an office in the physics building. And it was intense. I mean, there was not a lot of time for fun. Anyway, I mean, I did have fun. I had a very good social life, and there was the girls' college down in town and things like that. So, I mean, it was a very good, balanced social life at the school. And that's part of what college is. But when I left and I went back and I talked to some of my professors like 10 years later, they said everything has changed. Because there were 10 physics students out of the whole campus. There were only 10 physics students. And these were people that could make the grade and were going on to graduate school and beyond, PhD level program. And so anyway, what happened is the college said, it's costing too much money. You have to lower the standards, accept more people into the physics program. And the standards went way down. And then here's what literally happened to raise all of these tuitions to where they are today. When I was teaching at Cornell, 1979 to 81, the tuition was $65,000. That was 1979. That's what those guys were paying then. Whoosh. You know, and I was teaching there. But, and so anyway, that's a whole nother story. But here's what happened to the average college, private school, university, etc., even state universities. The colleges realized that mom and dad had paid for their house. Junior and sis, the kids, had grown up. And so, you know, an 18-year period. So mom and dad were busy working, paying off the house. So by the time the kids got ready for college, they had quite a bit of equity in that house, you know, to the tune of maybe a few a few hundred thousand dollars. So they could write off that equity against student loans, and that's what happened. So the colleges said, hey, we can really bump up our prices because that money is available. And it's the old thing, like, I'll give you an example. When I was younger, I lived in Mexico. And when I first went there, a can of Coca-Cola, just a regular 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola in the United States was like $1.50. But in Mexico, it was like one peso. Like, you know, so it was like there were 8 pesos to the dollar. So it's like 12 cents for a Coca-Cola. And I said, hey, how can they sell Coca-Cola here for 12 cents a bottle? And in the United States, it's $1.50. Well, it's called what the market will bear. That's what the colleges and universities did. They charged what the market would bear, knowing that these parents would sign up for these student loans, government-assured student loans. And by the way, that's kind of a con, too, as most people have found out if you signed up for student loans. You had to put something up in lieu of the loan, like mom and dad's house or something. Anyway, so the colleges realized that all this money was available in the mortgages of houses, and they could tap into this and raise their tuitions, and mom and dad would gladly pay it because they thought that son and daughter were going to get this 4-year education, get a better job, and go out and, you know, be able to conquer the world. Well, then the other thing that happened at the same time is all of the standards of the colleges got watered down. And so somebody getting a degree in the 1970s or 80s or 90s or even 2000s, typically the majority, and then they created a lot of new courses, a lot of new degrees, let's put it that way. And I won't go into all of that. But anyway, the end result was that the colleges way overpriced themselves. So when this COVID-19 thing came rolling along, wham, they had to shut down. All of a sudden, people realized, wait a minute, what are we paying all this money for? These kids are graduating and they can't get a job. They're not being prepared for a career. And so it really kind of set the stage for what's going on now. So now you have all these colleges and universities, private, publicly funded, state universities, state college systems, etc., empty. And I'll give you another example. When I was a kid, the plumbers were making a lot of money because if you had a broken pipe, you know, these pipes were rusted together and you couldn't get them apart. It took a plumber to come over to your house to get these pipes apart to fix the plumbing in your house. And so, I mean, they kind of had a market. So they raised their prices and raised their prices. And I remember as a kid, my parents and other people complaining the price of plumbers was just through the roof, but you needed them. There was nothing you could do because if you had leaky pipes in your house, you had to call that plumber. Okay, it's kind of like the medical industry today. I wish, don't let me go there. But anyway, when I was a kid, so anyway, what happened is all of a sudden there was a recession. People didn't have enough money. But something else happened at the same time. It's called PVC tubing. And so anyway, they made fittings that would hook into the old piping. And now, you know, Dad, Mr. Handyman, when the plumbing broke, could go down to the hardware store or the, you know, and buy this plastic tubing and kind of jerry-rig the plumbing in the house and fix it, and then it worked again. Saving, and so the plumbers, all of a sudden, they priced themselves out of business, and at the same time, PVC tubing came in, and they were out of business. There are still plumbers, but not like there were when I was young. It was a trade. It was a lucrative trade. I had friends whose parents, whose dad was a plumber, and they did far better than my dad, who had a different kind of job. Anyway, the point is that the universities have priced themselves out of existence. And so they're sitting there now wondering what to do. And, of course, they've got the coronavirus thing going on, which is fake also. I'm not saying that the coronavirus is fake, but the issues could be handled very nicely if they managed it. And a lot of these universities could stay open and become profitable. But they're succumbing to the fear of lawsuits because of the fact that if a teacher gets sick or a parent or a student gets sick or something like that, mom and dad would run to the university, get an attorney, and sue the school. Or the teacher gets sick, gets an attorney, sues the school. So the university schools are all running scared because they're all afraid of being sued. The reason I'm talking about this because China closed down for a period of 3 weeks back in February during their national New Year holiday, and they've been open ever since. There's a picture that came out recently of 70,000 people in a stadium in China, nobody wearing masks, all cheering their teams on. The United States is being shut down artificially for political reasons. That's very simple. And one of the collateral damage entities is the university college systems. Anyway, it's really a tragic situation because the United States overnight is falling way behind in educating our young people. And if you think some kid sitting at home looking at a computer screen, if you're just, I don't care what you're studying, if you think that that takes the place of being in a classroom with an experienced teacher, somebody that's very knowledgeable, you are wrong. And, you know, these colleges and universities are producing a course, and it's going to cost them some money up front to produce that course. But next year, they'll use that same course again, and the next year, the same course again, and the next year, the same course. So all this upfront money, they're going to be using year after year after year, and charging people the same amount of money. I personally have developed my own education course that's available on my webpage, but that is to replace the devastatingly bad science curriculum that exists in K-12 and university today. Okay, so anyway, I think it's important on this Thanksgiving Day to put things into perspective and understand that the United States is really in a bad situation. And I said this on John Moore's show where I was guest yesterday morning. I'm always a guest on John's show on Wednesday morning. But I said that the United States has never been in a more vulnerable position than it is right now. Period. It's open to foreign attack. It's open to attacks within. It has politicians. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, or whatever. The political world is extremely corrupt. And it's not a partisan Democrat versus Republican. It's a Democrat and Republican. Extreme corruption in Washington, D.C. And that leads me into a topic, and this is not political. I came up with a plan, and I thought at least I'll expose this on my radio show. I talked about it a little bit yesterday on John Moore's show, but here's a potential solution for the quandary that the United States finds itself in today. It's politically divided, no question about that. I think everybody will agree with that. Whether you're Democrat, Republican, for Biden, for Trump, or whatever, the United States is very divided. within families, whether you think about, say, support for police or not support for police, or open borders or not open borders, whatever it is, what are the hundreds of issues that are going on today? America is very divided. Okay, but the thing that you notice if you look at the political maps is that they are also geographically divided. So you find that places like Seattle and Portland and the San Francisco Bay Area and Los Angeles and Las Vegas and Denver, Colorado and Minneapolis, Minnesota and Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin, Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. You find the Miami-Dade area of Florida. If you look at the red and blue map on the county level and going even down to the precinct level, the red and the blue is very divided. So you'll cross a street in, say, pick a state, pick a county. If it's red, it's going to be real red. If it's blue, it's going to be real blue. And so here's my proposal as a way of solving this quandary. And that is, we're going to have two presidents. Because the people that want to be have Trump as their president don't want Biden, and the people that want Biden for their president don't want Trump. So here's what we do. We simply divide the, and this is, by the way, this goes back to Solomon. Remember Solomon in the Old Testament? The wise old Solomon, you know, people would go to him and make decisions. So anyway, there's the story about Solomon, that two women come to him and they have a baby and they're fighting over whose baby this is, if you can imagine this. This is a real story. And so Solomon says, deliver the baby to me. So Solomon is holding the baby there, and both women are claiming that this baby is her baby. And of course, Solomon, how is he going to know? So he says, get my axe. I'm going to cut the baby in two, and I'll give you each part of the baby. This is a real story. And I hope it doesn't offend people out there. And then what happens is the real mother comes screaming, no, don't cut my baby in two. And the other one that was the pretend mother, the fake, didn't react at all. Well, he knew who the real mother was, because the real mother would rather give her baby away than have it cut in two. This is a story. Anyway, the United States is much in this similar situation today. And I have my beliefs. Many people out there have their beliefs. But I think you could agree on one thing, is this country is really divided. So what you do is you take those extremely blue areas and you make Joe Biden the president of those areas and all the things that they want, open borders and, Obamacare and whatever, Bidencare, whatever they call it. All of the plans that those people have then would be implemented in those blue areas. And then all of the things that Trump wants would be designated in the red areas. And we'd have literally two countries. And you might think, well, this is pretty crazy. But if you look in a country like, say, Beirut, and or there are many other countries like this where you have many factions living in the same country. And so the end result is that the certain groups of people only deal with, and these are regionalized also, they only deal with people in their region. And it's a way of working out, because these groups are so polarized. Anyway, that's my solution, and is to literally divide the country. And then Joe Biden would take Washington, which is 100% blue, because all of the people who live in Washington, D.C., I'm talking Washington, D.C., and Richmond, Virginia, for example, would be a blue area. And all of those people would then be Joe Biden, you know, would be their president. And the rest of Virginia, which is totally red, would belong to Trump's United States. And then just divide it. Go, okay, here we go. There we go. That's the way we're going to solve this. It's the Solomon solution. I'm not going to mention any more about politics on this show, because a lot is going on. There's a lot of other people covering those topics. And I'm going to get off to a listener wrote in, and I'm going to see if I can quick pull up this email. And here it is. It says, let's see, I think it would be very interesting, popular, and instructive if you would give a timeline of major events in history based on your knowledge and best guesses. And so anyway, it talks about the last ice age, Great Pyramids, the Nazca Lines, where I've made some major discoveries. And then when was the moon captured by Earth? Just a few topics here. When a huge civilization population on the west coast of South America was drowned, wiped out. The pole shift, moving the North Pole away from just north of Lake Superior. And when Mars lost its oceans, atmosphere, life through the comet becoming Venus. And then he says, please, when you mention Venus, don't get off on a tangent about Belikovsky. And so anyway, well, Belikovsky does major work, very good work, and is one of the great researchers. But anyway, I'm going to attempt to give a timeline here. And this is something, too, that's I've decided to dedicate part of my show to students. So if you look back at the rest of this particular show, this is something that really applies to students. Okay, but anyway, let me make some major observations here about everything you've been taught about history. The idea that man came across the Bering Strait, these primitive hunters, and they followed the elk or whatever, the mastodons, and they came across, and then they populated, excuse me, what we now call the Americas. Nah, complete garbage, complete garbage. There were people living in South America long before that speculated event ever happened. Very advanced civilizations, I might add. So we're going back thousands of years. And one thing that's very clear is that there were a number of major worldwide events. And so I talk about this. I have two MP3 set, 18-hour lectures. It's two CDs in a set on my webpage that are part of my product line. But it's 18 hours MP3 lectures of the history of Planet X and ancient celestial disasters. And when I say Planet X, it's a generic term. It's a generic term because Planet X revolves around something that we have not defined. We have not identified it. And whenever, I will qualify that also by saying that you would not look up in the sky and see some round ball moving through the solar system. You're going to see a comet. And I talked a little bit earlier about the diamonds, for example, proof that something very different than what standard science is telling you, something very different is happening. And because these diamond layers are all around the world, it's not due to some asteroid crashing into Earth and through pressurized activity, creating diamonds that splatter all over the Earth. That's not the way it happens. The diamonds are created in outer space. And by the way, just to supplement that with real information about laboratory construction of diamonds, you can observe this in a laboratory. If you take carbon in a gas in a vacuum tank in a laboratory, take carbon, like a piece of carbon, and vaporize it, so you have carbon gas. Carbon, not carbon dioxide, not carbon in any other molecular form, just carbon. Carbon vapor in a vacuum chamber, and then you introduce an electrical discharge of electrons, and the diamonds start forming. You can do this in a laboratory, so it's not a big deal. And so that's proof once again, and then you combine that with the understanding that the electron beam in my plasma discharge comet model is doing the same thing. It's an electrical discharge of electrons with a carbon-rich environment in a vacuum. Same exact thing. So, gee, what would you expect to form there? Diamonds, microdiamonds, and diamonds of all sizes in those electric fields. Okay. But in what I've stated before and in my two CD set is that there were some major Earth-wide events. There was the Noah event, which was the Noah's Flood. That was a worldwide flood where torrential rains for 40 days and 40 nights, where we passed through the tail of a large comet. Okay, before that, the Earth's population was very large. In fact, potentially larger than what it is today. And the entire world population was destroyed. It was almost a mass extinction event. And that's the Noah's Flood, and there's other recounting of that particular event. So where standard history deviates from this is where they say, oh, they assume that nothing really happened that was major, that there was just this slow evolution of people. And what they have to come up with are these stories about man migrating across the Bering Strait, a land bridge when the ocean levels were lower. Well, gee, why were the ocean levels lower? Because the Great Flood had not occurred yet. And so they can't explain to you why all of a sudden the ocean levels rose. That's the first major flaw in standard knowledge, that where did all this other water come from? Well, it rained torrentially for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, so that's a very complicated story in itself. But the point is, the world population was very different prior to that. And remember that the atmosphere was very different. Remember that after the Noah's Flood, the rainbow appeared in the sky. Nobody had ever seen a rainbow before. So the atmosphere of Earth changed dramatically after the Noah's Flood. Okay, then there was the Venus event, which according to Velikovsky, which is the best estimate that I can see right now, this is not my estimate, this is Velikovsky's, and in lieu of any better estimate, that's the one that I would say is the best estimate that I can see, would be about 1550 BC is when Venus came through the solar system and affected Earth on two different occasions. You see this in the Mayan Popol Vuh, etc. And so this is potentially the time there were great tidal waves. If you look at the Mayan legends, the tremendous tidal waves were part of this event. And my goodness, I'm running out of time here. I've got less than a minute to go. But anyway, all of this is written in my books and my CDs and my DVDs, etc. And I'll just repeat, I have a sale on my books. Everything is greatly discounted so that people will have access to these to give as gifts, etc. Remember that if you buy two or three water filters from my sales page, then we will ship to two or three places. Free shipping, and typically shipping is a major expense. So you can get your Christmas presents. We will send them to the various people that you choose. All of that information on my webpage, the JMCC wing generators, etc., all there. The webpage, jmccsci.com. Once again, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.